teaching, and why I came to write it, really, which was, throughout my career of offering farms advice, I kept coming across, you know, you always come across those farmers that just seem to be good at it. And I got a bit curious as to why that was so. And through my work of working with farmers and trying to help them unravel that secret, I did a lot of research into different surveys and, academic studies, and it just kept coming back to these three themes of, in broadacre agriculture, crops, people and money.
G'day listeners, you're listening to the Farms Advice podcast, where we talk everything agribusiness. This week's an interesting one with our first author, Dr. Kate Burke, joins us to discuss her new book, Crops, People, Money and You. It's a great book to see, a book with purpose, as Kate has been on a mission helping farmers to understand their true potential.
So that's, and there's such a gap, Jack. The really good farmers are earning twice as much money as everyone else, and so there's the flip side of looking at that is there's this huge potential there for people to improve returns. And I sort of got a bit sick of hearing all the negative stuff about ag, and so I just wanted to put out the message that of hope, really, that if you have a real crack and have some and learn how to master those three things, there's a lot of upside.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good. Like for me, my New Year's resolution was to get stuck into books, one book a month this year.
Yeah, great.
And then when you're doing that, you're looking at like American books or books from the UK. There's nothing too within Australia about Australian. There's like stories and everything, but not about building Australian agribusiness as such like that. So it's good to see another book coming out.
Yeah, well, that was one of the other motivations was, there's books like Bill Malcolm's Farming Game Now and Australian Agriculture, those sort of textbooks from uni.
300 pages long.
And really academic. But then there's this huge gap and you're into lifestyle books like beekeeping and, basically lifestyle farming books, and there's nothing in between. And so I was really motivated to write something readable, I suppose, a bit like the Barefoot Investor for farming.
Yeah, well, if it's anything like Barefoot Investor for farmers, you're on the right track.
Yeah, I hope so. That's the plan.
Just need to get that guidance, I suppose. So we may as well get stuck into it, Kate. Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, sure.
It's great to have you. So you're actually Dr. Kate Burke.
Yeah.
What did you study? What's your doctorate?
Oh, so my background's in agricultural science and a PhD years ago in agronomy and plant breeding.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
Basically,
my background has been in Victoria. My background's been in consulting, one-to-one consulting, and then some time in corporate ag. I've been working for myself as an advisor with Think Agri for the last 5 years. So that's the snapshot. But all based in Victoria, but working nationally.
So you've got agricultural roots yourself, or you've been thrown into the deep?
Yeah. No. I grew up on our family farm. Is still operational here in Northern Victoria, and it's 150 years old. So we've been around for a while.
So you're still traveling through the family.
Yeah. My brothers and nephew are the current custodians.
Yep, that's great. We sold our family farm on the 90th year, so a bit sad that we didn't get to century.
Yeah, where did you grow up, Jack?
Kenya way.
Oh, wow. Yeah, pretty tough country out there.
Yeah, it is. And then moved into the central west of New South Wales, so it's going well. But talk to me a bit more about your Crops, People, Money and You, the book you're bringing out. have brought out. What led to this and where's it going?
Yeah, thanks, Jack. I guess I've been working with farmers for the last 30 years now. It makes me feel a bit old. I was really fascinated why some farmers are just really good at making decisions and just seem to have a knack for making the right decision at the right time. So I did quite a bit of research as to what makes a successful farm business and what drives operating returns. And all the studies, regardless of whether it was grain farming, which is my background, hence the word crops, or whether it was dairy or sheep, it just kept coming back to these three themes of being really good at your production, so crops, really good with money, so having a profit focus, and having a knack with people and yourself. So being able to manage yourself, but also have good relationships with other people. And so you can get things done and have good support networks and basically make good decisions and get everything done on time. And it just seemed that combination leads to a magic recipe that ends up with, 25% of the farming population earning twice as much as their peers.
Yeah, it's good. It's good that you've established those different traits. I think everything stems from what you said, communication, the people skills, as then the follow on from production and then turning it into a profitable business. That communication down through the line has to be there.
Yeah, absolutely, Jack. And I guess traditionally when you look at how farming evolved in Australia with big pastoral farms and hierarchy and, getting in shearing teams and contract labour, we probably haven't been so good on the people side. And we sort of expect to communicate by osmosis, a bit like the other day my husband went into the bakery and I said, how about we get something sweet? And in my head, I wanted a piece of caramel slice and he came out with apple cake. And when I mentioned that I was expecting caramel slice, he said, well, you didn't actually ask for caramel slice. And I think that happens on farms every day.
Yeah, even if it's a miniature like communication or something a bit larger.
Yeah, correct, exactly. So it's something we haven't been taught. Like we get taught how to, if you grow up on a farm, you get taught the nuances of production and operation and machineries virtually from the first time you, drive in the ute with your dad feeding sheep or sit on his knee or your mum's knee in the tractor. And I guess the money stuff's a bit the same but the communication stuff, we're not really taught that. And it's such a critical skill.
Absolutely. I've got a funny story. We've got two paddocks, Wattle and Wallaby. And Dad just said, we've got a sheep stud, so I had to go get the ewes in. And then he just sort of mumbled, and I thought he said Wallaby. But like the two paddocks, one's an hour muster and the other's half a day. And I ended up getting the Wattle ones in, which took me half a day, and then got them into the yards, and we wanted the Wallaby ones in instead.
Classic.
So looking at that sort of communication, it's funny. It's not funny at the time with me and my old man, but later on down the track, you learn a bit from those hiccups.
Yeah. If you're not sure, ask. That's probably the lesson there, isn't it? And give clear instructions in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. And especially if you're coming onto the farm and you're not within the family and don't really want to speak out too much, but you should when you got big decisions or small decisions to make, just to make the day flow a lot easier.
That's right. And one of the things I'm passionate about is taking lessons out of more formal workplaces, I suppose, based on from my short time in corporate agriculture and the time I spent working in universities and the public service. a few meetings can actually save a lot of time, and our informal habits on farm, you know, we could save a lot of confusion by just having a quick toolbox meeting on a Monday morning or at the front of the shed, just to articulate what's going to happen for the week, or even a quick 5 minute one first thing in the morning. But because we're involved with family, we don't tend to do that formal communication. And when it is done, it makes an enormous difference. And that's one of the traits of some of these high performing farms, is that they are prepared to take some of the business practices out of, I guess, the formal business world and incorporate them on farm.
Yeah, and actually be running as a business.
Correct. Because they are, you know, they're big businesses. There's a lot of land, capital tied up in land and in turnover. And there wouldn't be too many businesses where you're, you know, turning over excess of $1 million and sometimes up to $5 or $10 million, and it's all run intuitively, based on the communication of a few grunts at breakfast.
Yeah, definitely. Well, a little excerpt from your book was like, you don't need to be a huge farm in order to be profitable, looking at how we can better become more efficient.
Yeah, correct. That's one of the things I wanted to cover off in the book is a couple of assumptions that are made that aren't actually true. And one of those is many of the benchmarking studies done, they consistently show that for each farm size, whether that's by turnover or by hectares, there'll be a range of returns. So that size itself isn't the determining factor of profit. You know, size certainly helps if you've got a really good business and it's churning over profit, and then you can make it more efficient by getting your overhead costs down if you're running your machinery over more hectares. But if you've got a business that's got inefficiencies in it, and it's sort of poorly run, for want of a better term, you know, a larger business, Bill Malcolm, one of the agronomist professors, you know, makes a comment that a larger non-profitable business just creates a bigger loss, compensate and get that profit going. So I think that one of the excuses we hear is, oh, I'm not big enough. My neighbour's bigger. And really, as long as you match your overheads to the size of your farm, you can still run a really profitable farm.
Yeah, of course. And what do? Do you work off like percentages? Do you recommend to work off percentage and benchmarking for farm?
Oh, look, I'm not as hung up on benchmarks as some, but certainly there's some handy ratios when it comes to machinery investment for the size of the farm or the amount of grain you're producing. There's some handy investment ratios in terms of turnover and overheads. So I think, though, it's really important to understand that all this research points to the most significant driving factor are the individual characteristics of your farm business. So we just need to be a little bit careful about using sort of broad benchmarks, because if it doesn't apply to your specific industry and your specific area, it may not actually apply to you.
Yeah, definitely. We can't just take a broad landscape of Australia as a benchmark. But
yeah, correct. And even within the district, we sort of assume that that must be soil type differences or, you know, a rain shadow created by a hill or something like that. But it just seems to always come back to the decisions made on the individual farm is the most important factor. And that's a positive, Jack, because that means that if we work out what those decisions need to be, both at and understand our financial position and also how we're traveling production-wise relative to our potential based on rainfall, it means we've got a lot more control than we perhaps think we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like benchmarking on yourself is how you can better become and like grow step by step each year. Benchmarking like to yourself, improving your own enterprise.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something I'm really passionate about is understanding how your business goes and then trying to explain why it's performing the way it is. So at a whole of business level, but also at a enterprise and down to a paddock level, because in broadacre ag, quite often it's the characteristics of individual paddocks that and the cumulative effect of that that drives profit. So things like herbicide resistance, for example, and weeds are often the biggest profit limiting factor.
Yeah, of course. For like 2020 and like going over to 21, we're looking at a bumper harvest, maybe the second on record. Do you think like farms are coming under more pressure to perform, and these smaller farms may be looking like they're getting kicked out, but they should just be lifting their own efficiencies?
Yeah, look, it's always, you know, sometimes it's always a bit daunting if you're surrounded by larger farmers, but across my community and the clients I work with and friendship groups, you know, we've got a really broad range of scale and right across the country too. And in most cases this year, you know, yeah, again, scale's probably irrelevant to success. And it's really, the success seems to be a reflection of good agronomic decision-making throughout the year. And we're really seeing the rewards in the harvester at the moment to making some good decisions and getting good advice and thinking things through and during the season and being mindful to avoid sort of just the media noise and making sure you're using good information to make your decisions and working well with your agronomist, for example, and using the weather forecasting materials and making sort of, I suppose, continually monitoring and then making decisions along the way. It wasn't an easy year this year on the East Coast, particularly in Southeast Australia, because we and the same over in the West. We had, the rain was very sporadic, so we had, you know, a good start for us and dry start in the West, then we had quite a big dry patch and then promise of rain at the end. So it took quite a leap of faith to feed the crops with nitrogen in those conditions.
Yeah, just luckily a lot of the crops weren't wiped out with what was expected, the La Nina coming through.
Yeah. And look, that's right. So, harvest has been quite kind, thank goodness, and I guess there's still potential for some rain in the next couple of months based on the weather indicators at the moment. But so back to your question about being more efficient, the short answer is yes, but every farm needs to be efficient but also precise at the same time.
Getting your numbers in order, do you mean, or...?
Getting your numbers in order, but precision. Often we get efficiency mixed up with simplicity. Yep. We like to keep things simple and easy.
Yeah, I get you.
In the name of efficiency, but off basically, you know, we're humanly tempted to take the easy route, And sometimes the easy route isn't actually the most efficient or productive route.
Yeah. Looking at like the variables of like even in a paddock, one end's really good, one's pretty crap.
Yeah. Or I suppose, for example, you know, using, well, let's say with our wheat crop, you know, we might have a 2,000 hectare farm and there's 1,000 hectares of wheat. And we say, well, for efficiency's sake, we just got to keep the nitrogen rate all the same.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, by doing that, you might be overfeeding some paddocks and underfeeding others. Yep. So you're giving away profit under the assumption of efficiency.
And with that, like the farmers should see results pretty well, like after that crop's grown out.
Yeah, and we're seeing that some of the clients I've been working with that are really quite detailed and precise when it comes down to making nitrogen decisions and are prepared to have different rates for different paddocks. They're very satisfied this year because they're getting extraordinary yields and making at least APW in some cases H1, so they know they've sort of got the mix right. And things like doing soil testing, there's temptation not to want to do soil testing in the middle of summer because it's hot and annoying and and you feel like you're spending money on stuff and you're not sure what you're going to get for it. But it, you know, it's the cheapest investment going around to do soil testing, particularly deep, you know, 0 to 60 centimetres or an appropriate level of subsoil testing for your nitrogen bank.
Yeah, it's just not a teaspoon depth anymore. You got to get like fair chunk down there.
Yeah, yeah. So the 0 to 10, the surface tests still have their place for things like phosphorus and pH and all those sort of basic tests like organic carbon, but for things like nitrogen and sulfur and in some environments potassium, having that extra information at depth is really important, and it's well worth, you know, finding someone who's prepared to do it. Often I think I sympathize with this, it's the agronomists that aren't too keen on doing the soil testing in February.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also like the data, like as soon as you do start doing it, a lot of the farmers would be, shit, I should have done this 25 years ago. And you would have had that huge chunk of like research for your own farm.
Yeah, the guys that, like, that's the guys that I've worked with, you know, have done that and they've got, you know, an amazing data set. And we've used that. We had an example a few years ago where after a couple of tough years where we went back through sort of 10, 15 years of soil test data and looked at the phosphorus history.
Yep.
And we were able to work out from that which paddocks could we cut right back on in this coming out of a tough year, a poor cash flow season, and which paddocks we should get tested to just make sure, and then which paddocks we needed, you know, we couldn't afford to scrimp on. So rather than having the sort of the blank, well, let's just either forego phosphorus or cut the rate right back across the board, we were able to be really precise about it and save, you know, a significant amount of money in the fertiliser bill that year by doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that money can be transferred into, I don't know, infrastructure investment, or it can be saved for a rainy day.
Yeah, yeah. Or in this case, we're able to then use that allocation for nitrogen fertilizer later on in the season or other variable cost inputs. It just sort of went into that pool, but it was good to have that bit of extra cash. Compared to sort of just doing the same old thing every year and putting out a base rate without really thinking about it.
Yeah, definitely. We all have a bit of cash on hand. Never goes astray. For four farming businesses, working overseas in like marketing departments, forward planning was always a huge thing. We always had to do like 5 or 10 year forecasts. With farming though, it's completely different. We need to be reactive to the way the environment works with us. How, like, what's your recommendations on like 2 years forward planning, not doing it at all, or 6 months?
I think the short answer is all of the above.
Yep.
I think the bare minimum is having a good solid plan for the coming season, but that plan's adjustable.
Yep.
There's key trigger points where you may adjust the production plan. In terms of the overall business, it's probably something as an industry that we don't do that well. But again, it fits under the traits of crops, people, money. There is a trend that people that perform quite well financially are planners and strategic in their planning. And I guess we, because we, you know, we like to be out and about and doing stuff rather than sitting down at a kitchen table or in an office, planning gets the bad rap.
Yeah.
But I, you know, my business plan is literally on a cardboard beer carton box on the inside, because of the little circles, gives you sort of a framework, and I'm quite visual, and you know, I prefer to write things by hand, and cardboard's a bit more robust than scrappy bits of paper. So it doesn't have to be, you know, a 30-page document you know, an expensive process to do some planning and get it out of your head. It's also a way of improving communication by planning forward. So I liken it to cleaning out the top drawer. Like, we've all got a messy top drawer somewhere, whether it's in the kitchen, in the bedroom, or in the workshop, or at the glove box of the ute.
Yep.
And planning is really just emptying that top drawer, sorting it all out, and then placing it all back neatly in the top drawer again so it makes sense.
Absolutely. It's just piecing all the puzzles together. I think as long as you've written it down, that's a good place to start. Get it out on a piece of paper.
Yeah. That's right, Jack. And I guess for those farmers that tend to be more, you know, keep things in their head or not used to doing the writing down themselves, that's where engaging the services of an advisor or a facilitator or using the depth within the own business. Quite often now, you've got uni-educated guys and girls like yourself coming back on the farm that have written plenty of assignments, and as soon as they get back on the farm, they start being tractor drivers and forget about their assignment writing skills. And basically, a business plan is just a big assignment. So I think we can utilise the skills we've got within our business as well.
And as long as like everyone comes down to the personal skills, you spoke about the three principles. Everyone knows that business plan, like from your employees out in the paddock.
Correct. And that's I think because sometimes we're not natural communicators with the people close to us and with our employees, getting some help to facilitate that communication and makes the planning process easier. And I guess that's the sort of thing I do with clients is I'm the person that helps the sort of the unsaid stuff get said and then get communicated so that everyone's on the same page and often we make up stories about in our mind about what people are thinking, and we're too scared to, you know, broach certain subjects. And nine times out of 10, when it is a conversation is conducted, you'll find that everyone's on the same train of thought. They just weren't game enough to ask each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, like, for people listening to this podcast or reading your book, purchasing your book, they're halfway to being a successful farmer, if not already. How can we reach those others that, like, aren't looking so, like, as much as the other farmers that are looking to be innovative?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, we all learn from each other. So I think that's what I like about the world, the community, you know, community, whether it's the community on Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook, you know, those virtual communities, or whether it's or Snapchat, Instagram, or whether it's the community at the local footy club, or, you know, the pub in the small town, or farming systems groups. There's, I think, those that are listening to this or reading the book, you know, if they've got mates that they think could do with a hand, you know, it might just be a matter of sort of inviting them along to in the days when we could go to field days, along to a field day, or flicking them a podcast to have a listen to, or you know, buying them a copy of the book for their birthday.
Christmas coming up.
Just a little shameless plug in there. yeah, Christmas coming up, exactly. And often I just know I really appreciate getting sort of gifts that help me develop myself in terms of business or just personal development. And, yeah, I think if it's done in the right way, it's just a matter of helping people improve their awareness, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that's a shameless plug at all. I got you on the show because, like, it's good to have a book that's relevant to me and, like, heaps of others that I know. And I think agriculture needs to start plugging themselves a bit more.
Yeah, correct, Jack. That's something I'm really passionate about. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, I just wanted to collate the evidence to demonstrate both to the farming community and to mainstream media that agriculture is actually a very fruitful ground for creating wealth when it's done well. And, yes, we have really difficult seasons and runs of seasons, just like we've had at Your Way in New South Wales over the last few years. But we also have some very good seasons. And when that variability is managed well, you know, in our family farm that's been going for over 150 years, there's been plenty of runs of droughts and plenty of runs of good times. And it's just a matter of, saving the money from the good times and so you can ride out the bad times.
It's all about smoothing out that line, isn't it? To stop the spikes and the drops. And just bring it up into something controllable.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, when we're talking publicly, like, the media loves a good disaster, and the drought situation gets a lot of coverage and a lot of sympathy, and that's lovely. And it's nice to know that people have got your back when you're not travelling so well. But we're very reluctant to talk about our good times, and there might be a passing reference. And the moment we talk about our good times, you know, you tend to get shot down because not everyone's doing it well this year, for example. But when there's a drought, you know, there can be some areas that can have five good years in a row, but the whole emphasis is on the drought. So I think if we can just accept that there will be times of you know, low production and difficult times, and there will be times of better production and better income, And rather than sort of catastrophizing the tough times, I think mentally we'll be in a better place to make good decisions. And, you know, and I know it's awful. I grew up in drought. So I've shifted sheep. You know, in 1982, I was in year nine and spent every day of the school holidays reading a book up the one end of Sheep on the Road while the dog was tied up the other end. So I've lived through that uncertainty as a kid and obviously worked. You know, I was a agronomist all the years through the millennium drought, so sort of became an expert in frost management, drought management and counselling farmers really. So I'm not diminishing the emotional effect of drought. I'm just encouraging people to, we've just got to work out a better way to manage that mental load.
Absolutely. And like drought comes and goes, but it's also a good time to look at the opportunities where you can look at your efficiencies, cut something off, or just plan ahead as much as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And it's really, you know, if I think if we have the mindset in periods of drought of just minimising our losses, and I've seen businesses do this rather than drought periods being huge losses, you know, now they've got their drought management down that they might make a loss of sort of, you know, between 0 and 1% in terms of return on capital. And it just, so those really hard losses have been eliminated out of their system. And it just means that you can, you've got a lot more, I guess, depth in your business to ride out a tough time.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. So, like, writing the book, what was your favourite part?
Oh, it's a good question, Jack. I think there's a couple of things. One was writing the anecdotes.
Yeah.
And drawing on my family history and funny stories of people I've worked with and farms I've worked with to demonstrate a point. That was really good, and creating the models and the diagrams and the drawings and just trying to represent, you know, fairly technical and financial information in a really simple way. That was my intention. It's really satisfying to get to the end of it and think, I think I've done what I set it out to do.
Yeah, I bet it would have been a relief when you got it done, looking all at the words day in, day out.
Absolutely, Jack. If you can imagine your most stressful uni assignment ever and multiply it by about 1,000, that was the process. But as you know, first time author, I've gained a lot of respect for people that write books, you know, every year. Not sure I'll be able to do that, but I know I've got a few more books left in me, that's for sure.
So you're going to have another crack?
Yeah. I'll try and keep doing this. I really enjoy writing, and it's one of my happy places.
Will it be like a sequel? Like a tag along?
I'm not sure. It might be just smaller targeted pieces. Yeah. You know, like perhaps I might do something on buying land and getting more control over that, because that's a real, you know, it's for those that are wanting to grow and expand, sort of waiting for farmland to come up for sale can be quite stressful. And I reckon there's opportunity to actually be a little more proactive and set yourself an expansion plan and then try and make it happen, as opposed to just waiting for the block next door to come up on the market.
Yeah, that's it. Don't wait for the moment.
Yeah, and succession planning is something, and again, it's mainly about the conversation.
Yeah.
I think there's quite a bit of that in the back of the book. There are a couple of guidebooks out there around succession planning, but I think I wouldn't mind putting together a bit of a workbook so that you know, a bit of a simple how-to or like a barefoot investor's guide to succession planning to take the fear away from it and get those conversations started.
The barefoot farmer coming up.
Yeah. Maybe. Although I think I'd better leave all that that brand to Scott Pape. Okay. But one of my friends suggested I should write a book called 50 Spades of Hay.
That's a pretty good one. I'll give you that.
Yeah. But, or another title that was suggested was Filthy Farming, How to Get Filthy Rich Out of Farming by Doing As You're Told.
You've got two books there ready to go.
Yeah, it looks like it. I might refine those titles a bit, though, I think.
So capturing the whole book might be pretty difficult, but what's one piece of farm's advice you would like to pass on from reading your book?
Yeah. The most important concept is that you're the one in the driver's seat. And it's all three, crops, people and money, that are important, but it's actually your decisions and your excellent choices by focusing on the controllables and learning how to manage the things that worry you. That's the key. That's the art of excellent farming.
Absolutely. I think that's a top piece of advice there to put into play to your own enterprise for anyone listening or reading Kate's book. It'd be great. Now, for yourself, we always ask the guests who they would like to hear on Farms Advice podcast and why. Just to pass the buck and keep that word of mouth going.
Oh, cool. Oh, I couldn't go past Professor Bill Malcolm from the University of Melbourne, Jack, if you haven't managed to get Bill on the podcast yet. He's a cracking fellow with a great turn of phrase and some of the funniest one-liners you'll ever come across. Grew up on a Mallee farm in Victoria and made a career out of being an academic. It's one of the wisest men in agriculture.
Absolutely. That's a top choice for that. Well, Kate, thank you very much for coming on the show. We'll round it off there. It's been great to get to know a bit about your book, but also like your backstory to it as well. Unreal.
Thank you, Jack, and congratulations on Farms Advice and your initiative with this. I really think you're on the right track, and I'm very passionate about one of the reasons I wrote the book was to get services into a product, and although this is an old school way of doing it, one of the things I'm really keen on doing is automating the opportunity for people to learn using digital services, and because I really think that's the way of the future. So well done in what you're doing, and let's hope we can do some fun stuff together at some stage.
Absolutely. Well, you get the Farms Advice 5-star appeal for our book reviews.
Good on you, Jack. Thank you.
You're also the first book that we've reviewed, so well done.
Oh, thanks for that. It's sort of like saying you're the best footy player in the team, but you're playing Aussie rules with a bunch of rugby players, isn't it?
Pretty well. Now, where can we find this book? Where can we buy it just before Christmas?
If you go to www.thinkagri.com.au,
yep.
There is, and on there, there's a book page, so it's just a matter of clicking on that, and those orders will process pretty quickly. So that's the go.
Excellent, and there's also a little teaser there, so if you want to read that. Thanks for listening to our last podcast for the year as we slip into Christmas mode. To everyone that has supported the podcast in the first 27 episodes, I'd like to thank you and hope you'd been able to take something away from each episode and any others you've listened to. Don't forget to please like, comment and subscribe to help the Farms Advice podcast reach every agricultural crevice in Australia. Visit farmsadvice.com.au for the show notes and also a link to buy the book for that farmer in your life or even yourself. Until next time, cheers.